Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Thursday, May 27th, 2010, on this rainy Bay Area day, I am delighted to welcome Lewis Gray of the eponymous lewisgray.com and recently tapped to be Managing Director of New Media at Paladin Advisors Group. Welcome, Lewis.
Thank you, Jennifer. Appreciate you for having me.
Great to have you on. It's been a long time coming. We've been trying for a while.
Absolutely, but it's going to be worth it.
So I want to dig right in. I think pretty much all of us in the Valley and outside the Valley that are into technology know you from your blog and the podcasting that you do or participate in all the time. And video casting, but you've recently taken a new role. Tell us about it.
Well, it's actually not so recent. We're almost about a year through it. But what happened was, about June of 2009, I was realizing that a lot of the activity I was doing online with the blogging and the advisory to startups and helping companies get off the ground was taking more and more of my time. And so it didn't make as much sense for me to be tied down to one job, one role, focused on a single brand. So I talked to a couple of former colleagues of mine. We said, let's do something new. Let's take that to the next level and become full-time consulting, focus on advisory for both enterprise companies that need to know new media and get it and do it right and integrate the strategy, but also those small companies and help them get off the ground and provide that early adopter type of feedback that I've been doing informally for a long time. So the company itself is not much talked about because I think we want to get to a stage where we're a lot larger and we have more clients before we really push Paladin in a big way. But we're on the verge of hiring some good folks, and I'll be excited to announce that. We'll be on the verge of launching the website officially really soon. But kind of in the quiet, I've been going out and helping enterprise companies, especially in the storage and networking space, get into new media, and it's been a lot of fun.
Can you tell us about any clients yet?
Sure. One of them was Emulex Corporation. Emulex is one of those companies that's done a really solid job for a long time, but they're not on the tip of the tongue of everybody in Silicon Valley. They're focused on the data center, working on host bus adapters, networking cards, fiber channel over Ethernet, all that good stuff. We've also picked up a number of clients, including Ocarina Networks, which is focused on data compression and storage optimization. So again, that kind of core hardware enterprise space that I'd been participating in the last decade was kind of like the alter ego to lewisgray.com. Lewisgray.com was all about consumer brands and Google and Facebook and Yahoo and Apple. But when it came down to it in the nitty gritty, we were working with terabytes and gigabits and all that fun stuff. On the side of companies that you do know, you may know MySixthSense. MySixthSense is one of the companies I advise for from Paladin. And they have a fantastic tool, which is on the iPhone today. They've just launched an API that is intending to get your digital intuition. Basically, look at all the social streams you visit, the RSS, the Facebook, the Twitter, really anything, and pop up the most important thing that is relevant just to you, not because of what someone else says or because of an editor's decision, but because of your own intuition. And so I really appreciate what they're doing, trying to cut through the noise and find the signal. It's something that all of us are trying to do a better job of.
Interesting that they use the word intuition, because you think of that as something instinctual, but I assume there's an algorithm behind it that actually powers it.
Absolutely, and they're really incredible. You know, we're meeting with their artificial intelligence scientist later today, probably an hour after this podcast is concluded, to find out even more about their next steps. But what they've done is they've taken the approach, instead of looking explicitly, you know, if I ask you, what do you like, you'll tell me. You'll say, I like football, I like mountains, I like the Bay Area. And you can try and guess at what people like based on that. And that's what a lot of sites do. But instead, they just watch your behavior. You know, if you click on an article, that's basically a signal that you're interested in that topic, that source, keywords in that article. And the more you do it, the better it gets. So for someone like me who reads hundreds of RSS articles per day, looks at about 1,000 people I'm following on Twitter, goes to Google Buzz, goes to Facebook. I want a tool like this to pull the best stuff from my stream so I don't have to be up 24/7.
Yeah, it reminds me of We talked to Mark Smith last week, who's a sociologist, but a high-powered one at that, who actually has come up with a NodeXL, which you may know. He does visualization of, you know, influence around particular topics, or it doesn't have to be influence, but it can be, you know, backlogs in companies and kind of where that, you know, where the siloing is being a problem, things like that. But NodeXL is actually free, and it helps you organize your email by what's most relevant to you based on your behavior. So that sort of thing I think is just fascinating and such an emerging area. I love hearing about it 2 weeks in a row.
Absolutely. I think it's something that's really catching on. I think every couple of weeks I see somebody coming with an approach that tries to find a personalized filter. In my opinion, and recognize my bias that's there because I'm so close to it, I think my sixth sense is really focused on it as a company. You know, you see other people try and use it as a feature, but they've built the entire business around getting this right, and they've worked for a couple of years getting the algorithms just so. And now they have this opportunity to take an API and apply it to any stream that you've got. So if you look at CNN.com, assume if that were powered by My Sixth Sense, you would see those things that are most relevant to you, not necessarily what's most relevant to people who like Hollywood and celebrity news or different type of politics than you do. But if you start to see personalization and filtering everywhere, it could change the game in terms of the way that you take in data.
Wow. You know, the sound of Edward R. Murrow rolling over in his grave. But, you know, I think you're right. I mean, people have less and less time, so it's like this compressed way of looking at the world, you know, just seeing what is relevant to you. So one thing I wanted to ask you about was, you know, obviously you're a name that we hear, you know, lewisgray.com, and we talked before this podcast about, you know, how you'll get sent releases at the same time other companies or find out news at the same time that they did. Tell us about the journey of lewisgray.com and the work that you had done prior to that so that people get a little bit more context about how you came to be who you are.
Sure. That sounds kind of fun because it's one of those things I don't usually talk about. I try to make the blog not about me. And it's a funny thing to say for somebody who has the blog name in the URL. You said it was eponymous. Really, that kind of goes back to my owning the domain name 10 years ago or 11 years ago, and I just had it and thought it was cool. And the idea was to put the blog as like a subpage of the website. I was going to build out a flat website and have sections for sports and technology and church and family, and then there'd be this blog in the corner. But the blog kind of got a life of its own. I finally found a solution that worked for me in 2006 where I could publish multiple times a day really quickly, have tags on what I wanted to do. And the reason I started the blog was because my family had had a blog from 2003, 2004, but any time I would put a post up about Apple or Google, it would get no comments. But, you know, my brother would put a post about some carpentry work he'd done in the backyard and it would get like 10 comments. And so I was thinking, you know what, this really isn't my audience. You know, they're my family, but they don't really care about the things I care about. So I kind of thought it was time to break out and do my own thing. So lewisgray.com was intended to start to just be anything I was talking about. I would cover the A's, the 49ers, the Sacramento Kings, but also technology. But what I found was over time, not only did I have more interest in that early adopter phase, but I got a lot more really solid response of companies listening to what I was saying and making changes as a result. I had a lot of good success probably in early 2007 from places like LinkedIn and Google that took suggestions that I had on the blog and said, here, we've implemented a few of these, or thanks for your feedback. We were just an all-day meeting. We came to some of the same conclusions you did. And so I started to think that I was onto something, that if I played that role of early adopter, I could make change. And so that's been a fun role to play, somebody who has gotten an opportunity to see tools like TweetDeck before anybody else, to launch social networks like SocialMedian before anybody else, and try and talk about something that no one has ever seen in a way that makes sense. I still look back to that post that I did in July of 2008 on TweetDeck, and I think, what was new about this? It was an error application. It had multiple columns. It had the ability to make groups. It had integrated Surmise search. Remember, this is before Twitter bought Surmise. Mm-hmm. And so how do you take this new story, new product, and execute it in a way that makes sense. And so I look back at that headline now, and it talks about new Twitter error application with columns, comma groups, comma integrated semis, right? And it was just, how can I cram all these features in one place? So that was a lot of fun. But, you know, outside of the blog, previous to that, I went to Cal Berkeley. I was focused on politics and mass communication, which is as close to journalism as I could get. So it was pretty much a step change to get into writing not only on the blog, but also in the real world job of helping with corporate communications and public relations. So I'd gone from being a
Cal. You should have joined us in the English department.
The hard part was I really kind of started writing for the newspaper instead of English. And so I would go to these English classes and turn in papers that were full of 1- and 2-sentence paragraphs, which is the way that you're taught for journalism, and just get raped for it, right? I mean, the professors that are there would always expect you to have a paragraph that was like half a page. And I was like, no, here's my, here's the who, what, where, when, why. What do you need 10 more pages for? So that didn't always go over too well. But I definitely saw myself change in the way that I approached writing because of journalism. And that's something that stuck with me when I write press releases for companies, when I write emails for my parents, when I write blog posts. It all kind of came out in the same formula.
Interesting.
So
Sorry, go ahead. Finish your thought.
I was just going to say the transition. So I went to Cal, and when I was at the student newspaper there, I was the online editor, and we put the stories on the web back when we had just a gray text and blue links. So I've been putting stuff online going back to 1995 officially on that type of stuff, and then just transitioned from the Daily Cal student newspaper there to my first startup in 1998, which now that we look back at it, it was kind of like Black Hat SEO. We just didn't know that's what it was called. And we would work on highlighting internet influence for companies and finding out how many backlinks they had on AltaVista and Excite. And then that transitioned into more of a marketing role.
That's amazing. That's very, very cool. I love those startup stories. I was just telling my husband about the startup that I was at in the late 90s, early 2000s that was translating local television newscasts into an interactive format, but there was really no way to monetize it. So, in the end, it went away. But it was an invaluable experience. It was fabulous.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we've all kind of gone through that. And you look often at the valley, and we talk about these successful companies, but the truth is still there that 9 out of 10 are not a success. So a lot of us toil away at these companies with these bright aspirations that don't pan out, don't get over the curve. There was another one I worked at from 98 to 2001 where we had this amazing web-based meeting tool, and it was phone conferencing online, internet faxing, all these communications in one place that were eventually going to drive to having an online office. But because of the company's slow growth and a combination of the economy and everything else, we didn't get the B round of funding. So they cut marketing, biz dev, went down to bare bones, and eventually sold to Oracle. But the subtext is that WebEx was doing something very similar, and they had a $35 million marketing budget, and we had like 3 people. So it was hard to beat RuPaul at the Super Bowl.
That's very true. One thing that I think is interesting about the title of your new role is new media, and maybe because I come from a TV background. So I started out, in the more traditional roles from reporting to producing to eventually executive producing and went online very quickly. And we were called new media, then we were called emerging media, and now we're sort of digital media. And since I was early at, finding communities to drive traffic, social obviously is a huge component. Community building is a huge component of my particular skill set. And so when I think of new media, I think of, God, that's what they called us a while ago. And I thought it was interesting that it was like you almost kind of brought the word back for me anyway, and I don't know if I'm the only one thinking this, but I just thought I'd ask you about how you came up with the title for your role or how it came about.
Well, I think what we want to avoid is having a role or a title with 10 words in it. I think what a lot of people don't know me as is someone who gives a lot of feedback for PowerPoint presentations and figuring out messaging for VC pitches, helping companies with a public relations strategy, getting onto their website and doing a lot of reviews. But you know, you don't want to throw that into a title. But what I also wanted to avoid was the phrase social media. I think I just recently did a video about that. You know, a lot of people are talking about social media experts and social media gurus, and it really grows tiresome that we kind of have this bitter back taste in our mouth. But the truth is that there are a lot of companies that are enterprise, corporate. They know their own messaging. They know their own company, but they don't have a clue when it comes to these new areas. So we thought it made more sense to call it new media, make it broad. Yes, we do social media, but it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more than saying, hey, here's a Facebook page plus a Twitter account. Anybody can go do that. The question is, can we get really integrated into your business so that everybody internally is thinking about all the different places that their message can be sent and all these different places that people can be talking about you? What's the fastest way to respond? What's the right way to respond? And so new is broad enough that, you know, I don't have to change my title in 2 years when social media goes out of vogue.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think the what I've been saying is that social media expert or social media consultant is sort of what I, you know, what I think of SEO consultant was a year or 2 years ago. You know, it screams snake oil salesperson. And, you know, in at Social Media Club, you know, where I'm on the board is, you know, the, you know, when we talk behind the scenes, I know there's a few people on the board who've actually changed their business card so it doesn't say social media anymore. And it's you know, it's interesting from that perspective. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you going back to, so going toggling back and forth, the concept of early adopter, one of the, some of the feedback that I got before we started chatting was, you know, how do you become an early adopter when you just don't know about things? How do you get in the loop to begin with? And I find that people asking me that actually at Social Media Club events, or they ask me that anyway, but they're specifically asking that now, and I'm wondering if you could sort of address that, because one of the things that I think people don't take into account is, one, that you publish opinion about the things that you, you know, are looking at, and two, that you've probably been pretty good with your predictions about what would succeed and fail, kind of in the way that Robert Scovel has, and because of that, you then continue to get invited. But how does it start?
Well, I think it's, you asked a pretty broad question there. There's multiple things to answer. One of the things about being an early adopter is that you often utilize products before they're fully ready, and sometimes you really believe in a product that is great but doesn't succeed. I think Robert is a perfect example of that. I think he has really taken a lot of time to focus on specific networks that haven't panned out. He and I both were big adopters of FriendFeed. We believed strongly in that product. We thought it was excellent. And it didn't get the mainstream adoption we'd hoped for. It got acquired by Facebook, and kind of pieces of FriendFeed are kind of everywhere now. You know, you see the like button on Google. You see the like button on Facebook. You see some of the filtering on Facebook that FriendFeed had. So you kind of see it everywhere, but it's not the same. Social Median was one of those sites that got purchased by Zing. And it was a good product, but also it didn't grow to the level that we all thought it could. On the flip side, TweetDeck did, and it's obviously a very major success. They've gotten funded by BetaWorks.
Yeah, and the weird thing, I think, or no, maybe weird is the wrong phrase, but, you know, when I talked to, we talked about this, I talked to Ian Dodsworth, that, you know, and interviewed him for the first time about TweetDeck, and he said his vision was to create a browser, and it actually still is. It actually had nothing to do with being a client for Twitter. It just so happens that that was where success came first. So it you know, it's interesting how these things happen, but, you know, how do you get privy to the behind-the-scenes or behind-the-wall, you know, does it happen one time and then you kind of get invited back, or, you know, as mentors continue?
That's a good question. And what I look at is, when I started the blog in 06, it really didn't take off or get any kind of activity until probably a year and a half in. So I was really just talking to myself and having a good time. But what happened by the end of 07 is I'd written an article, which I look at it as kind of like a step change for me. This is what really started to push forward. Is I was a heavy user of Google Reader, as was Robert, and I put an item that said 10 suggestions for Google Reader how to improve. And it got a really good feedback. It started to make me think that I was onto something. And a few months later, a company came out called AssetBar, and AssetBar said, here's what you asked for. And they put in 10 things about a next-generation RSS reader, and it was identical to what my post was. They'd effectively used my post as their marketing requirements document and executed from there.
Wow.
So I saw that and found it and said, wow, this is amazing, and started talking about that. And so they brought me in and gave me a preview of their product. And theirs was the first time where I would have the chance to debut a product and be the first guy on the scene. And I was really nervous about it. I told them, I said, look, guys, you know, nobody reads my blog. This is going to bomb. No one's going to comment on it. But I thought, I'm going to have to do a really bang-up job on describing what they do to give them the best opportunity. So I took a lot of extra time to really explain their product and put screenshots in and walk it through, so that it did go live and enough relevant people saw it. And from that, there just started to be a slow trickle of similar things. I found a company called ReadBurner in February of 2008 just because I was looking at my referral stats. And any good blogger looks at their referral stats to see where people are coming from. So I saw a referral from a site on Amazon Web Service that didn't even have a domain. And it was a new product that no one had ever talked about before. So I wrote about it. And then that led to more and more and more. It just started kind of by chance to find these other companies like AssetBar and ReadBurner, both of whom are nowhere now, right? I mean, this is one of the things you talk about making a bet. Sometimes you bet on companies that go away. But AssetBar and ReadBurner catapulted me into the visibility of other people in that social RSS space doing these weird things with the web. And that's how it started.
Which sets you up nicely to answer, you know, a question about, you know, most people do prediction posts end of year, beginning of next year. Do you do prediction posts? Do you do the mid-year review of what you were right about or things that you think will change? I saw that you had an interesting post recently about Foursquare and accompanying pre-post about somebody new joining and a post podcast discussing changes there. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So there's two questions in that. One is around prediction and the other is around Foursquare. I started doing predictions just like everybody else, probably in 07 or 08. And I think anybody can make a prediction that Apple's going to come out with a faster processor Mac next year, right? Anybody can make a prediction that Google is going to introduce features to Google News. And so what I wanted to do was take a risk and write about things that probably weren't going to happen just for fun. So, for example, I made a prediction at the end of 2007 that Twitter was going to introduce images and video and make that part of the stream so it wasn't just text. I was wrong. You know, they still haven't done it. Obviously, they've made it easier for TwitPic and other places to integrate, but I said this is what I think they're going to do. I made a prediction in the end of 2008 going to 2009 that both FriendFeed and Twitter would remain independent and not be bought or go public. I was wrong. FriendFeed got bought. So I don't mind being wrong so long as we're thinking about something else. And every once in a while we do happen to be right, and people like to see that, you know, at least we took a stretch and we got 3 or 4 out of 10 right. I got an award in 2008 for making the worst predictions. It was from HubSpot.
I was just going to say, who gave you that award? Brian Halligan.
and M.G. Siegler got the best awards. Like, M.G. had what I thought were more mainstream predictions, so he was more likely to get them right than I was. But he got the first place, and I got last. So I think actually someone else finished last, and I was next to last, but the other person was so mad they didn't want the award, and I said, fine, go ahead and give it to me, because it was funny.
So
about Foursquare. So Foursquare is one of those that a lot of people are talking about and a lot of people are using. And again, it's kind of like Twitter in that it's getting significant growth and people aren't exactly clear why they're using it and they're not exactly clear where the revenue is going to come from, but their friends are on it. You know how it goes. So just like Twitter, despite the fact I say I'm an early adopter, I was a little bit late to that too. I looked at it and said, look, I'm not a single guy who's going out to clubs and going to the bars all the time. I'm married. I've got kids. I've got a job. So who wants to know if I'm a mayor of my office in my house? Who wants to know if I'm at the fridge or the couch or the TV? I'm going to be so boring. But I thought, I'm just going to give it a whirl because if I don't do it, then I'm going to sound like the guy who's just playing sour grapes and doesn't know the tool. So I've been using it, and I've been using it in a way that favors transparency rather than filtering everything. I will check in at all these mundane places like 7-Eleven and the gas station and McDonald's, and I don't mind if people think I'm morbidly obese because I'm the mayor of Burger King and Wendy's at the same time. It just shows to me that Foursquare, which a lot of people are talking about, it hasn't even really made it down the San Francisco Peninsula. You know, you might have to fight for a mayorship in San Francisco, but I can own Woodside and Sunnyvale and San Jose with no problems at all. It's just not pervasive yet.
Yeah, I own my area too. And I
yeah, it's just, it's no contest.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's very cool to have that that happen. Interestingly, that kind of leads into another question that I wanted to ask you about. Stowe Boyd was on a couple of months ago, and he was talking about how he'd moved east, and part of the drive to move east was that he felt like, and I'm paraphrasing here, but that Silicon Valley was sort of operating under the umbrella of failure. Because of this, you know, another dot boom, right? And that, you know, innovation, in his example, I believe at the time was, you know, if you look at, for example, geolocation, Gowalla is out of Austin and Foursquare is out of New York City or New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's, I think, out of Silicon Valley. But in any event, that you know, there was real innovation without this, you know, feeling of dread of failure or potential failure happening other places. And I'm just curious what your take is on that. You know, companies
well,
in other places.
I don't know how he can come to that conclusion. You know, when we were at LeWeb, they talked quite a bit of the European entrepreneurs being afraid of failure and that they get stuck, that they failed somewhere. What the Silicon Valley is well known for are second chances and third chances and fourth chances. If you look at the Foursquare guys, you know, they tried Dodgeball. It got acquired by Google, and then Google didn't do anything with it. So they tried again, and they're getting Foursquare right. The world of Silicon Valley is full of people who have not only been successful once or twice, but it's full of people who were unsuccessful several times before becoming successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't see that Austin and New York are more failure-friendly than the Valley. I mean, the Valley has not only more history, but they have more access to academia, they have more access to qualified engineers, they have more access to capital in one place than anywhere else. You know, I'm literally 5 minutes from Sand Hill Road if I got in my car and drove down there, and then you could just go knocking on doors, right? You can't do that in Austin. You can't do that in New York City.
Interesting. So now, are you a native to the Bay Area?
I sort of. My birth certificate says San Jose, but it's deceptive. We never really lived here. That's just where I was born. We kind of moved to Guadalajara, Mexico for 3 years, lived in Baltimore, Maryland, lived in Denver, and then was in California pretty much since the mid-80s. So I've been in California forever. And after going to Berkeley, I've been here in the Bay Area ever since. So that's been 15 years.
Very cool. Yeah, my birth certificate says San Jose, too. Were you born at Good Samaritan Hospital by any chance?
No, I think it's at Santa Teresa, which is like now a Kaiser.
Yes, definitely. I remember my mom and dad going there for different things. But in any event, we're coming close to the end here, and I just thought that it would be interesting to get your take on anybody anybody that has, you know, that is on the scene, I guess, at the moment. It seems like we're in kind of a time of change. There was an interesting thing that happened or dynamic that happened at our last social media club event where people actually wanted to be on the panel, and we had to turn a number of really, you know, fairly well-known names away just to keep the panel down and to, you know, try to keep the mix of voices at the level that we wanted. What do you think of this sort of jockeying for position? Do you feel, I feel like, and I've talked with Brian Solis about this, which I mentioned to you, about this worry that, you know, I have and, you know, others have that, you know, people are almost too obsessed with being really well known. And, you know, you had said something to me earlier before the podcast about, you know, writing well is probably what got you where you are in a sense. And I just thought that that would be a nice note to end on if you could kind of expound on that a little bit.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I think there's way too much focus on personal branding. A lot of people are talking about that and how do you go about cultivating a personal brand? How do you get known? How do you raise your numbers and in all these various networks? And the answer is through providing quality, period, right? People wouldn't pay attention to anything that Brian Solis said or anything that I say if we weren't surfacing voices of other interesting people, if we weren't having opinions that were worth discussing. So I do not believe that I've done anything intentional to my personal brand. I don't think about it. I do want to make sure that the way I'm represented online does reflect me, right? I do want to have someone who is trustworthy, someone who can stand for something and then explain why we got to that conclusion, someone who doesn't look biased, or where you think I'm biased, I can explain how I got to that position. What I do like about somebody like Brian is I know that he not only talks about the craft, but he executes against it. There's a huge amount of respect I have for the fact that he works with his startups and his other companies and tries to get them to do the right thing. And then he turns around and offers advisory roles and panels to people like me and others in the industry to find other voices. So if people are fighting for a spot on a panel, it might not be a panel you want to listen to at the end of the day because they're just up there to be up there.
Yeah.
So you won't see that for me. I love it when people reach out and say, I had you in mind for this. And I'll say, okay, well, let's find out if that's the perfect role, and then we'll go ahead and participate and try and do a good job. But what I'm not doing is putting a section up on my website about contact me for speaker things because I don't think that's right. I think if you're going to go be a speaker, it's because you have value and people are asking you to be there, not because you did a better marketing job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the value of the personal brand. I really wonder, you know, Generation Y is supposed to be less focused on the personal and more focused on the group, and I really wonder if Generation X and as Y becomes, you know, obviously there's the sort of in between the two, but as Y kind of develops and gets a little bit older, if that will fade or continue to be the trend that we've all come to know and some loathe, some love, some embrace.
You talked about Web 1.0 and that startup boom and crash. If you remember the Web 1.0 days, we were talking about all these people trucking in from Cleveland to make it rich in the Silicon Valley. And when that gold rush didn't pan out, a lot of them left. I think social media specifically is going to be seeing the exact same thing. Not so much in terms of the number of clients and all those sites that are there. Yes, that's happening. They're consolidating. Some are going away. But just in terms of the number of users and the volume of users. I'm not saying the number of people using Twitter and Facebook are going to decrease, but a lot of these people who are on there all day, it is impacting their jobs, is impacting their social life. And so what they need to do is find balance. And I think a lot of people are tilting toward being constantly connected at the expense of doing a good job elsewhere. And I think there's going to have to be a flow of balance, and people are going to take a step back.
Excellent points. You are such an interesting guy to talk to. I wish we had more time with you, but unfortunately we both have press schedules today, and hopefully we'll get to have you on again.
Well, I appreciate it, Jennifer. The phone lines are always open.
All right. Thanks. This is Lewis Gray signing off. You have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
All right, and that was, again, Lewis Gray of lewisgray.com and Managing Director of New Media at Paladin Advisors Group. Thank you for tuning in to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. If you like the show, we'd be delighted if you'd friend us or add us to your favorites here on Blog Talk Radio or rate us on iTunes. And be sure to tune in tomorrow when my featured guest is Jeremy Toman of Stage 2 Consulting. That's tomorrow starting at noon Pacific. As always, you can keep up on the latest with this show, archives, and free webinars at jenniferlindsay.com. Have a great weekend if you take off early tomorrow.